to do?
They all shook their heads. Good. And don't go blaming me if you get yourself killed. Three Trees stood up and the others followed him. They made their last few preparations, loosening blades in sheaths, pulling at bowstrings, tightening buckles. There wasn't much for West to prepare. A heavy stolen sword pushed through a weathered belt, and that was it. He felt an utter fool in amongst this company. He wondered how many people they had killed between them. He would not have been surprised if it had been a whole townful, with enough left over for an outlying village or two. Even Pike looked more than ready to commit careless murder. West had to remind himself that he had not the slightest idea why the man had been convicted to a penal colony in the first place. Looking at him now, running a thoughtful thumb down the edge of his heavy axe, eyes hard in that dead, burned face, it was not difficult to imagine. West stared at his hands. They were trembling, and not just from the cold. He grabbed one with the other and squeezed them tight. He looked up to see the dogman grinning at him. "Gotta have fear to have courage," he said, then turned and followed Three Trees and the others into the trees. Black Dow's harsh voice hacked at West from behind. "You're with me, killer. Try and keep up." He spat on the frozen ground, then turned and set off towards the river. West took one last look back towards the others. Cathill nodded to him once, and he nodded back. Then he turned and followed Dow, ducking through the trees in silence, all coated with glittering, dripping ice, while the hissing of the waterfall grew louder and louder in his ears. Three Trees' plan was starting to seem rather short on details.
"Once we get across the stream and we get the signal, what do we do?"
"Kill," grunted Dow over his shoulder. That answer, useless though it was, sent a sudden stab of panic through West's guts.
"Should I go left or right?"
"Whichever you like, long as you stay out of my way."
"Where will you be going?"
"Wherever the killing is." West wished he had never spoken as he stepped gingerly out onto the bank. He could see the falls just upstream, a wall of dark rock and rushing white water between the black tree trunks, throwing freezing mist and noise into the air. The river here was no more than 4 strides across, but the water flooded past, quick and dark, frothing round the wet stones at its edges. Dow held his sword and axe up high, waded out steadily, up to his waist in the middle, then crept up onto the far bank, pressing himself dripping against the rocks. He looked round, frowned to see West so far behind, jerked his hand angrily for him to follow. West fumbled out his own sword and lifted it up, held a deep breath, and stepped into the stream. The water flooded into his boot and round his calf. It felt as if his leg had been suddenly clamped in ice. He took a step forward, and his other leg vanished up to the thigh. His eyes bulged, his breath came in snorts, but there could be no turning back. He took one more step. His boot slipped on the mossy stones on the bed of the stream, and he slid helplessly in up to his armpits. He would have screamed if the freezing water had not hammered the air out of his lungs. He floundered forward, half stumbling, half swimming, teeth gritted with panic, sloshed up onto the far bank, breath hissing in shallow, desperate gasps. He staggered up and leaned against the stones behind Dow, his skin numb and prickling. The Northman smirked at him.
"You look cold, boy."
"I'm fine," spluttered West through chattering teeth. He had never been so cold in his life. "I'll do my part."
"You'll do your what? I'll not have you fighting cold, boy. You'll get us both killed."
"Don't worry about it."
Dow's open hand slapped him hard across the face. The shock of it was almost worse than the pain. West gawped, dropping his blade in the mud, one hand jerking up instinctively to his stinging cheek.
"What the—"
"Use it,"
hissed the Northman at him.
"It belongs to you."
West was just opening his mouth when Dow's other hand smacked into it and sent him staggering against the rocks, blood dribbling from his lip and onto the wet earth, his head singing.
"It's yours. Own it."
"You fucking—" The rest was nothing more than a mindless growl as West's hands closed round Dow's neck, squeezing, clawing, snarling like an animal, teeth bared and mindless. The blood surged round his body, the hunger and the pain and the frustration of the endless freezing march spilling out of him all at once. But Black Dow was twice as strong as West, however angry he was.
"Use it!"
he growled as he peeled West's hands away and crushed him back against the rocks.
"You hot yet?"
Something flashed overhead and splashed into the water beside them. Dow gave him a parting shove, then sprang away, charging up the bank with a roar. West struggled after him, clawing the heavy sword up out of the mud and lifting it high, the blood pulsing in his head, howling meaningless sounds at the top of his lungs. The muddy ground sped by underneath him. He crashed through bushes and rotten wood into the open. He saw Dow hack a gawping Northman down with his axe. Dark blood leapt into the air, black spots against the tangle of branches and white sky. Trees and rocks and shaggy men jolted and wobbled, his own breath roaring in his ears like a storm. Someone loomed up, and he swung the sword at them, felt it bite. Blood spattered into West's face, and he reeled and spat and blinked, slid onto his side, and scrambled up. His head was full of wailing and crying, clashing metal and cracking bone. Chop, hack, snarl. Someone staggered near him, clutching at an arrow in his chest. West's sword split his skull open down to his mouth. The corpse jerked, twisting the blade from his hand. He stumbled in the dirt, half fell, lashed out at a passing body with his fist. Something crashed into him and flung him back against a tree, knocking the air from his lungs in a breathy wheeze. Someone had him fast around the chest, pinning his arms, trying to crush the life out of him. West craned forward and sank his teeth into the man's lip, felt the meat in the middle. He screamed and punched, but West hardly felt the blows. He spat out the flap of flesh and butted him in the face. The man squirmed and yelped, blood leaking out of his torn mouth. West clamped his teeth round his nose, growling like a mad dog. Bite, bite, bite. His mouth filled with blood. He could hear screaming in his ears, but all that mattered was to squeeze his jaws together, tighter and tighter. He twisted his head away, and the man reeled back, clutching at his face. An arrow came out of nowhere and thudded into his ribs. He fell to his knees. West dived on him, grabbed hold of his tangled hair with clutching hands, and smashed his face into the ground again and again.
"It's done."
West's hands jerked back, grasping claws full of blood and ripped-out hair. He struggled up, gasping, eyes bulging. Everything was still. The world had stopped reeling. Spots of snow filtered gently down into the clearing, settling across the wet earth, the scattered gear, the stretched-out bodies, and the men still standing. Tull was not far away, staring at him. Three Trees was behind, sword in hand. Pike's pink slab of a face had something close to a wince on it, one bloody fist squeezed round his arm. They were all looking at him. Dow raised his hand, pointing at West. He tipped his head back and started to laugh.
"You bit him! You bit his fucking nose off! I knew you were a mad bastard!"
West stared at them. The thumping in his head was starting to subside. "What?" he muttered. There was blood all over him. He wiped his mouth, salty. He looked at the nearest corpse, face down on the earth. Blood was trickling from underneath its head, running down the slope and pooling around West's boot. He remembered something. A sudden cramp in his guts bent him over, spitting pink onto the ground, empty stomach heaving.
"Furious!" shouted Dow. "That's what you are!"
Grim had already stepped out of the bushes, bow over his shoulder, and was squatting down, dragging a bloody fur from one of the corpses. "Good coat," he muttered to himself. West watched them all pick over the campsite, bent over and sick and utterly spent. He listened to Dow laughing.
"Furious!" cackled his harsh voice. "That's what I'll call you." They got arrows over here. The dog man pulled something out of one of the packs on the ground and grinned. And cheese. Bit dusty. He picked some mould off the wedge of yellow with his dirty fingers, bit into it and grinned. Still good, though.
Lots of good stuff, nodded Three Trees, starting to smile himself. And we're all still going, more or less. Good day's work, lads.
He slapped Tull on the back.
We'd best head on north quick before these lot are missed. Let's get what there is fast and pick up those other two.
West's mind was only just starting to move again.
The others. All right, said Three Trees. You and Dow check on them. Furious.
He turned away with half a smile. West lurched off through the trees the way he'd come, slipping and sliding in his haste, blood pulsing again.
Protect the prince, he muttered to himself.
He waded across the stream almost without noticing the cold, struggled onto the far bank and back uphill, hurrying towards the cliff where they had left the others. He heard a woman's scream, quickly cut off, a man's voice growling. Horror crept through every part of his body. Bethard's men had found them. It might already be too late. He urged his burning legs on up the slope, stumbling and sliding in the mud. Had to protect the prince. The air burned in his throat, but he forced himself on, fingers clutching at the tree trunks, scrabbling at the loose twigs and needles on the frosty ground. He burst out into the open space beside the cliff, breathing hard, the bloody sword gripped tight in his fist. Two figures struggled on the ground. Cathil was underneath, wriggling on her back, kicking and clawing at someone on top of her. The man had managed to drag her trousers down below her knees, and now he was fiddling with his own belt while he struggled to hold his other hand across her mouth. West took a step forward, raising the sword high, and the man's head snapped round. West blinked. The would-be rapist was none other than Crown Prince Ladislaw himself. When he saw West, he stumbled up and took a step back. He had a slightly sheepish expression, almost a grin, like a schoolboy caught stealing a pie from the kitchen.
Sorry, he said. I thought you'd be longer.
West stared at him, hardly able to understand what was happening.
Longer?
You fucking bastard!
Screamed Cathil, scrambling back and dragging her trousers up.
I'll fucking kill you!
Ladislaw touched his lip.
She bit me. Look!
He held his bloody fingertips out as though they were proof of an outrage perpetrated against him. West found himself moving forwards. The prince must have seen something in his face, because he took a step away, holding up one hand while he held up his trousers with the other.
Now, hold on, West, just...
There was no towering rage, no temporary blindness, no limbs moving by themselves, not the slightest trace of a headache. There was no anger at all. West had never in his life felt so calm, so sober, so sure of himself. He chose to do it. His right arm jerked out, and his open palm thumped against Ladislaw's chest. The Crown Prince gave a gentle gasp as he stumbled sharply backwards. His left foot twisted in the mud. He put down his right foot, but there was no ground behind him. His brows went up, his mouth and eyes opened with silent shock. The heir to the throne of the Union fell away from West, his hands clutching vainly, turning slowly to his side in the air, and he was gone. There was a short, breathy cry, a thumping sound, and another, a long clattering of stones. Then silence. West stood there, blinking. He turned to look at Cathil. She was frozen a couple of strides away, eyes gawping wide open.
You...
I know.
It hardly sounded like his voice. He edged to the very brink of the cliff and peered over. Ladislaw's corpse lay drooped face down over the rocks far below, West's ragged coat spread out behind him, trousers round his ankles, one knee bent back the wrong way, a ring of dark blood spreading out across the stones around his broken head. Never had anyone looked more dead. West swallowed. He had done that. Him.
He had killed the heir to the throne. He had murdered him in cold blood. He was a criminal. He was a traitor. He was a monster. And he almost wanted to laugh. The sunny Agrient, where loyalty and deference were given without question, where commoners did what their betters told them, where the killing of other people was simply not the done thing, all this was very far away. Monster he might be, but out here in the frozen wilderness of Angland, the rules were different. Monsters were in the majority. He felt a hand clap him heavily on the shoulder. He looked up to see Black Dow's earless head beside him peering down. The Northman whistled softly through pursed lips. "Well, that's the end of that, I reckon. You know what, Furious?" And he grinned sideways at West. "I'm getting to like you, boy." Chapter 34 To the Last Man.
To Sam Dan Glockta, superior of Dagoska, and for his eyes alone. It is clear that, in spite of your efforts, Dagoska cannot remain in Union hands for much longer. I therefore order you to leave immediately and present yourself to me. The docks may have been lost, but you should have no trouble slipping away by night in a small boat. A ship will be waiting for you down the coast. You will confer overall command on General Visbrook, as the only Union member of Dagoska's ruling council left alive in the city. It need hardly be said that the orders of the closed council to the defenders of Dagoska remain the same. To fight to the last man. Salt, Archlector of His Majesty's Inquisition.
General Visbrook slowly lowered the letter, his jaws locked tight together.
"Are we to understand, then, Superior, that you are leaving us?"
His voice was cracking slightly, with panic, with fear, with anger. Who could blame him for any one of them? The room was much the same as it had been the first day Glockta arrived in the city. The superb mosaics, the masterful carvings, the polished table, all shining in the early morning sun, streaming through the tall windows. The ruling council itself, however, is sadly reduced. Visbrook, his jowls bulging over the stiff collar of his embroidered jacket, and Haddish Kadia, slumped tiredly in his chair, were all that remained. Nikomo Koska stood apart, leaning against the wall near the window and picking his fingernails. Glockta took a deep breath.
"The Archlector wants me to explain myself."
Visbrook gave a squeaky chuckle.
"For some reason, the image of rats fleeing a burning house springs to mind."
An apt metaphor. If the rats are fleeing the flames to fling themselves into a mincing machine.
"Come now, General."
Koska let his head roll back against the wall, a faint smile on his lips.
"The Superior didn't have to come to us with this. He could have stolen away in the night and no one any the wiser. That's what I'd have done."
"Allow me to have scant regard for what you might have done," sneered Visbrook. "Our situation is critical. The land walls are lost, and with them all chance of holding out for long. The slums swarm with Gurkish soldiers. Every night we make sallies from the gates of the upper city. We burn a ram. We kill some sentries while they sleep. But every day they bring up more equipment. Soon, perhaps, they will have cleared space down among the hovels and assembled their great catapults. Shortly thereafter, one imagines, the upper city will come under sustained fire from incendiaries."
He stabbed an arm at the window.
"They might even reach the citadel from there. This very room may sport a boulder the size of a woodshed as a centerpiece."
"I am well aware of our position," snapped Glockta.
The stench of panic the last few days has grown strong enough almost for the dead to smell it.
"But the Archlector's orders are most specific. To fight to the last man, no surrender."
Visbrook's shoulders slumped.
"Surrender would do no good in any case."
He got up, made a half-hearted attempt to straighten his uniform, then slowly pushed his chair under the table. Glockta almost pitied him at that moment.
Probably he is deserving of pity, but I wasted all I had on Carlot Dan Ida, who hardly deserved it at all. Allow me to offer you one piece of advice from a man who's seen the inside of a Gurkish prison. If the city should fall, I strongly recommend that you take your own life rather than be captured.
General Visbrook's eyes widened for a moment. Then he looked down at the beautiful mosaic floor and swallowed. When he lifted his face, Glockta was surprised to see a bitter smile.
This is hardly what I had in mind when I joined the army.
Glockta tapped his ruined leg with his cane and gave a twisted grin of his own.
I could say the same. What did Stolichus write? The recruiting sergeant sells dreams but delivers nightmares?
That would seem appropriate to the case.
If it's any comfort, I doubt that my fate will be even as pleasant as yours.
A small one.
And Visbrook snapped his well-polished heels together and stood to vibrating attention. He remained like that for a moment, frozen, then turned without a word for the door, soles clicking loud against the floor and dying away in the corridor outside. Glockta looked over at Kadia. Regardless of what I said to the general, I would urge you to surrender the city at the earliest opportunity. Kadia's tired eyes slid up.
After all this, now?
Especially now. Perhaps the Emperor will choose to be merciful. In any case, I can see little advantage for you in fighting on. As things stand, there is still something to bargain with. You might be able to get some kind of terms.
And that is the comfort you offer? The Emperor's mercy?
That's all I have. What did you tell me about a man lost in the desert?
Kadia nodded slowly.
Whatever the outcome, I would like to thank you.
Thank me, you fool?
For what?
Destroying your city and leaving you to the Emperor's mercy?
For treating us with some measure of respect.
Glockta snorted.
Respect? I thought I simply told you whatever you wanted to hear in order to get what I needed.
Perhaps so. But thanks cost nothing. God go with you.
God will not follow where I am going,
Glockta muttered as Kadia shuffled slowly from the room. Koska grinned down his long nose.
Back to Adua, eh, Superior?
Back, as you say, to Adua.
Back to the House of Questions, back to Archelector Salt. The thought was hardly a happy one.
Perhaps I'll see you there.
You think so?
More likely you'll be butchered along with all the rest when the city falls. Then you'll miss your opportunity to see me hanged.
If I've learned one thing, it's that there's always a chance.
Koska grinned as he pushed himself away from the wall and strutted towards the door, one hand rested jauntily on the pommel of his sword.
I hate to lose a good employer.
I'd hate to be lost, but prepare yourself for the possibility of disappointment. Life is full of them.
And the manner of its ending is often the greatest one of all.
Well then, if one of us should be disappointed,
and Koska bowed in the doorway with a theatrical flourish, the flaking gilt on his once magnificent breastplate glinting in a shaft of morning sunlight,
it has been an honor.
Glockta sat on the bed, tonguing at his empty gums and rubbing his throbbing leg. He looked around his quarters.
Or Davoust's quarters. That's where an old wizard terrified me in the middle of the night. That's where I watched the city burn. That's where I was nearly eaten by a 14-year-old girl. Ah, the happy memories.
He grimaced as he pushed himself up and limped over to the one box he had brought with him.
"And this is where I signed a receipt for 1,000,000 marks, advanced by the banking house of Valentin Bulk."
He slid the flat leather case that Malthus had given him out of his coat pocket.
500,000 marks in polished stones, barely touched.
He felt again the tugging temptation to open it, to dig his hand inside and feel that cool, hard, clicking distillation of wealth between his fingers. He resisted with an effort, bent down with a greater one, pushed some of the folded clothes aside with one hand, and dug the case down under them with the other.
Black, black, and black. I really should get a more varied wardrobe.
"Going without saying goodbye?"
Glockter jerked violently up from his stoop and nearly vomited at a searing spasm through his back. He reached out with one arm and slammed the box lid down just in time to flop onto it before his leg buckled. Vitari was standing in the doorway, frowning over at him.
"Damn it!"
he hissed, blowing spit through the gaps in his teeth with every heaving breath, left leg numb as wood, right leg cramping up with agony. She padded into the room, narrowed eyes sliding left and right.
"Checking that there's no one else here. A private interview, then."
His heart was starting to beat fast as she slowly shut the door, and not just from the spasms in his leg. The key rattled in the lock.
"Just the two of us. How terribly exciting."
She paced silently across the carpet, her long black shadow stretching out towards him.
"I thought we had a deal,"
hissed out from behind her mask.
"So did I,"
snapped Glockter, struggling to find a more dignified position.
"Then I got a little note from Thalt. He wants me back, and I think we can all guess why. Not because of anything I told him."
"So you say."
Her eyes narrowed further, her feet padded closer.
"We had a deal. I kept my end."
"Good for you. You can console yourself with that thought when I'm floating face down in the docks in Adua, and you're stuck here waiting for the Gurkish to break down the..."
Oof!
And she was on him, her weight grinding his twisted back into the box, squeezing the air from him in a ragged wheeze. There was a bright flash of metal and the rattle of a chain. Her fingers slid round his neck.
"You crippled worm! I shall cut your fucking throat right now!"
Her knee jabbed painfully into his stomach. Cold metal tickled gently at the skin on his neck. Her blue eyes glared into his, flickering back and forth, glistening hard as the stones in the box under his back.
"My death could be moments away. Easily."
He remembered watching her choke the life out of Ida.
"With as little care as I might squash an ant, and I, poor cripple, just as helpless as one."
Perhaps he should have been gibbering with fear, but all he could think was,
"When was the last time I had a woman on top of me?"
He snorted with laughter.
"Don't you know me at all?"
he blubbered, half-chuckling, half-sobbing, eyes watering with a sickening mixture of pain and amusement.
"Superior Glockter, pleased to meet you. I don't care a good shit what you do, and you know it. Threats? You'll have to do a sight better than that, you ginger whore."
Her eyes bulged with fury. Her shoulder came forwards, her elbow went back, ready to apply the greatest possible pressure.
"Enough to cut my neck through to my twisted spine, I don't doubt."
Glockter felt his lips curl back in a sickly grin, wet with spit.
"Now."
He heard Vitari's breath snorting behind her mask.
"Do it."
He felt the blade press against his neck, a chill touch so sharp that he could hardly feel it.
"I'm ready."
Then she let out a long hiss, lifted the blade high, and rammed it into the wood beside his head. She stood up and turned away from him. Glockter closed his eyes and breathed for a moment.
"Still alive."
There was an odd feeling in his throat.
Relief or disappointment? Hard to tell the difference.
please.
It was said so softly that he thought he might have imagined it. Vitaria was standing with her back to him, head bent over, fists clenched and trembling.
What? Please.
She did say it, and it hurts her to do it, you can tell.
Please, eh? You think there's any place here for please? Why the hell should I save you, really? You came here to spy for salt. You've done nothing but get in my way ever since you got here. It's hard to think of anyone I'd trust less, and I don't trust anyone.
She turned back to face him, reached behind her head, took hold of the straps of her mask, and pulled it off. There was a sharp tan line underneath, brown round her eyes, her forehead, her neck, white round her mouth, with a pink mark across the bridge of her nose. Her face was far softer, much younger, more ordinary than he had expected. She no longer looked fearsome. She looked scared and desperate. Glockter felt suddenly ludicrously awkward, as though he had blundered into a room and caught someone naked. He almost had to look away as she kneeled down level with him.
Please.
Her eyes looked moist, dewy, her lip trembling as if she was on the very point of weeping. A glimpse of the secret hopes beneath the vicious shell? Or just a good act? Glockter felt his eyelid fluttering.
It's not for myself, she almost whispered. Please, I'm begging you.
He rubbed his hand thoughtfully across his neck. When he took it away, there was blood on his fingertip, the faintest brown smear. A nick, a graze, just a hair's breadth further, and I'd be pumping blood all over the lovely carpet right now. Only a hair's breadth. Lives turn on such chances. Why should I save her? But he knew why. Because I don't save many. He turned painfully round on the box, so his back was to her, and sat there, kneading at the dead flesh of his left leg. He took a deep breath.
All right, he snapped. You won't regret it.
I regret it already. Damn, but I'm a fool for crying women, and you can carry your own damn luggage. He looked round, raising a finger, but Vitari already had the mask back on. Her eyes were dry and narrow and fierce. They looked like eyes that couldn't shed a tear in 100 years.
Don't worry.
She jerked on the chain round her wrist, and the cross-shaped blade sprang from the lid of the box and slapped into her waiting palm.
I travel light.
Glockter watched the flames reflected in the calm surface of the bay. Shifting fragments, red, yellow, sparkling white in the black water. Frost pulled at the oars, smoothly, evenly, his pale face half-lit by the flickering fires in the city, expressionless. Severard sat behind him, hunched over, glowering out across the water. Vitari was beyond, in the prow, her head no more than a spiky outline. The blades dipped into the sea and feathered the water with barely a sound. It hardly seemed that the boat moved. Rather, the dark outline of the peninsula slipped slowly away from them into the darkness. What have I done? Consigned a city full of people to death or slavery? For what? For the king's honor? A drooling half-wit who can scarcely control his bowels, let alone a country. For my pride? Ha! I threw it all away long ago, along with my teeth. For Salt's approval? My reward is like to be a rope collar and a long drop. He could just see the darker outline of the rock against the dark night sky, the craggy form of the citadel perched on top of it, perhaps even the slender shapes of the spires of the great temple, all moving off into the past. What could I have done differently? I could have thrown in my lot with Ida and the rest, given the city away to the Gurkish without a fight. Would that have changed anything? Glockta licked sourly at his empty gums. The Emperor would have set about his purges just the same. Salt would have sent for me, just as he has done. Little differences hardly worth commenting on. What did Shickle say? Few indeed are those who get a choice. A chill breeze blew, and Glockta pulled his coat tight around him, folded his arms across his chest, winced as he worked his numb foot back and forward in his boot, trying to make the blood flow. The city was nothing but a dusting of pinprick lights far away. It is just as Ida said. All so the Archlector and his like can point at a map and say this dot or that is ours. His mouth twitched into a smile. And after all the efforts, all the sacrifices, all the scheming and plotting and killing, we could not even hold the city. All that pain, for what? There was no reply, of course. Only the calm waves lapping against the side of the boat, the soft creaking of the rowlocks, the soothing slap-slap of the oars on the water. He wanted to feel disgust at himself, guilt at what he had done, pity for all those left behind to Gurkish mercy. The way other men might. The way I might have long ago. But it was hard to feel much of anything beyond the overwhelming tiredness and the endless, nagging ache up his leg, through his back, into his neck. He winced as he sagged back on his wooden seat, searching, as always, for a less painful position. There is no need to punish myself, after all. Punishment will come soon enough.
Chapter 35 Jewel of Cities. At least he could ride now. The splints had come off that morning, and Giselle's sore leg knocked painfully against his horse's flank as it moved. His hand was numb and clumsy on the reins, his arm weak and aching without the dressing. His teeth still throbbed dully with every thump of the hooves on the ruined road. But at least he was out of the cart, and that was something. Small things seemed to make him very happy these days. The others rode in a somber, silent group, grim as mourners at a funeral, and Giselle hardly blamed them. It was a somber sort of place, a plain of dirt, of fissures of bare rock, of sand and stone, empty of life. The sky was a still white nothing. Heavy as pale lead, promising rain, but never quite delivering. They rode clustered round the cart, as though huddling for warmth, the only warm things in 100 miles of cold desert, the only moving things in a place frozen in time, the only living things in a dead country. The road was wide, but the stones were cracked and buckled. In places, whole stretches of it had crumbled away. In others, flows of mud had covered it entirely. The dead stumps of trees jutted from the bare earth to either side. Baez must have seen him looking at them. An avenue of proud oaks lined this road for 20 miles from the city gates. In summer, their leaves shimmered and shook in the wind over the plain. Juvens planted them with his own hands in the old time, when the empire was young. Long before even I was born. The mutilated stumps were grey and dry, splintered edges still showing the marks of sores. They look as if they were cut down months ago. Many long years, my boy. When Glustrod seized the city, he had them all felled to feed his furnaces. Then why have they not rotted? Even rot is a kind of life. There is no life here. Giselle swallowed and hunched his shoulders, watching the chunks of long dead wood file slowly past, like rows of tombstones. I don't like this, he muttered under his breath. You think I do? Baez frowned grimly over at him. You think any of us do? Men must sometimes do what they do not like, if they are to be remembered.
It is through struggle, not ease, that fame and honour are won. It is through conflict, not peace, that wealth and power are gained. Do such things no longer interest you?"
"Yes," muttered Giselle, "I suppose." But he was far from sure. He looked out across the sea of dead dirt. There was precious little sign of honour out here, let alone wealth, and it was hard to see where fame would come from. He was already well known to the only 5 people within 100 miles. Besides, he was starting to wonder if a long, poor life in utter obscurity would really be such a terrible thing. Perhaps when he got home, he would ask Ardy to marry him. He amused himself by imagining her smile when he suggested it. No doubt she would make him squirm, waiting for an answer. No doubt she would keep him dangling. No doubt she would say yes. What, after all, was the worst that could happen? Would his father be angry? Would they be forced to live on his officer's pay? Would his shallow friends and his idiot brothers chuckle at his back to see him so reduced in the world? He almost laughed to think that those had seemed weighty reasons. A life of hard work with the woman he loved beside him, a rented house in an unfashionable part of town with cheap furniture but a cozy fire, no fame, no power, no wealth, but a warm bed with Ardy in it waiting for him. That hardly seemed like such a terrible fate now that he had looked death in the face, when he was living on a bowl of porridge a day and feeling grateful to get it, when he was sleeping alone out in the wind and the rain. His grin grew wider, and the feeling of the sore skin stretching across his jaw was almost pleasant. That did not seem like such a bad life at all. The great walls thrust up sheer, scabbed with broken battlements, blistered with shattered towers, scarred with black cracks and slick with wet. A cliff of dark stone curving away out of sight into the grey drizzle, the bare earth in front of it pooled with brown water and scattered with toppled blocks as big as coffins.
"Aulcus," growled Baez, jaw set hard. "Jewel of cities."
"I don't see it sparkling," grunted Ferro.
Neither did Logan. The slimy road slunk up to a crumbling archway, gaping open, full of shadows, the doors themselves long gone. He had an awful feeling as he looked at that dark gate, a sick feeling, like the one he had when he looked into the open door of the Maker's house, as if he was looking into a grave, and possibly his own. All he could think about was turning round and never coming back. His horse nickered softly and took a step away, its breath smoking in the misty rain. The hundreds of long and dangerous miles back to the sea seemed suddenly an easier journey than the few strides to that gate.
"Are you sure about this?" he murmured to Baez.
"Am I sure? No, of course not. I brought us weary leagues across the barren plain on a whim. I spent years planning the journey and gathered this little group from all across the circle of the world for no reason beyond my own amusement. No harm will be done if we simply toddle back to Celsus. Am I sure?"
He shook his head as he urged his horse towards the yawning gateway. Logan shrugged his shoulders.
"Only asking."
The arch gaped wider and wider, then swallowed them whole. The sound of the horse's hooves echoed down the long tunnel, clattering around them in the darkness. The weight of stone all around pressed in close and seemed to make it hard to take a breath. Logan put his head down, frowning towards the circle of light at the far end as it grew steadily bigger. He glanced sideways and caught Luthar's eye, licking his lips nervously in the gloom, wet hair plastered to his face. And then they came out into the open.
"My, my," breathed Longfoot. "My, my, my."
Colossal buildings rose up on either side of a vast square. The ghosts of tall pillars and high roofs, of towering columns and great walls, all made for giants, loomed from the haze of rain. Logan gawped, they all did, a tiny huddled group in that outsized space, like scared sheep in a bare valley waiting for the wolves to come. Rain hissed on stone high overhead. Falling water splattered on the slick cobbles, trickled down the crumbling walls, gurgled in the cracks in the road. The thudding of hooves fell muffled. The cartwheels gently croaked and groaned. No other noise. No bustle, no din, no chatter of crowds. No birds calling, no dogs barking, no clatter of trade and commerce. Nothing lived, nothing moved. There were only the great black buildings stretching far away into the rain and the ripped clouds crawling across the dark sky above. They rode slowly past the ruins of some fallen temple, a tangled mass of dripping blocks and slabs, sections of its monstrous columns scattered on their sides across the broken paving, fragments from its roof thrown wide, still lying where they fell. Luthar's wet face, apart from the pink stain across his chin, was chalky white as he gazed up at the soaring wreckage to either side.
"Bloody hell," he muttered.
"It is indeed," murmured Longfoot under his breath. "A most impressive sight."
"The palaces of the wealthy dead," said Byers. "The temples where they prayed to angry gods, the markets where they bought and sold goods, and animals, and people, where they bought and sold each other, the theatres and the baths and the brothels where they indulged their passions before Glustrod came."
He pointed across the square and down the valley of dripping stone beyond.
"This is the Kaline Way, the greatest road of the city, and where the greatest citizens had their dwellings. It runs straight through, more or less, from the northern gate to the southern. Now listen to me," he said, turning in his creaking saddle. 3 miles south of the city there is a high hill with a temple on its summit. The Saturnine Rock, they called it in the old time. If we should become separated, that is where we will meet."
"Why would we be separated?" asked Luthar, his eyes wide.
"The earth in the city is unquiet and prone to tremble. The buildings are ancient and unstable. I hope that we will pass through without incident, but it would be rash to rely on hope alone. If anything should happen, head south, toward the Saturnine Rock. Until then, stay close together."
That hardly needed saying. Logan looked over at Pharaoh as they set off into the city, her black hair spiky, her dark face dewy with wet, frowning up suspiciously at the towering buildings to either side.
"If anything should happen," he whispered to her, "help me out, eh?"
She looked at him for a moment, then nodded.
"If I can, Pink. Good enough."
The only thing worse than a city full of people is a city with no people at all. Pharaoh rode with her bow in one hand, the reins in the other, staring to both sides, peering down the alleys, into the gaping windows and doorways, straining to see round the crumbling corners and over the broken walls. She did not know what she was looking for, but she would be ready. They all felt as she did, she could see it. She watched the fibers of jaw muscle tensing and relaxing over and over on the side of Ninefinger's head as he frowned off into the ruins, his hand never far from the grip of his sword, scored cold metal shining with beads of moisture. Luthar jumped at every noise, at the crack of a stone under the cartwheels, at the splatter of falling water into a pool, at the snort of one of the horses, his head jerking this way and that, the tip of his tongue licking endlessly at the slot in his lip. Kwai sat on the cart, bent over with his wet hair flapping round his gaunt face, pale lips pressed together into a hard line. Pharaoh watched him snap the reins, saw he was gripping them so tightly that the tendons stood out stark from the backs of his thin hands. Longfoot stared about him at the endless ruins, eyes and mouth hanging slightly open, rivulets of water occasionally streaking through the stubble on his knobbly skull. For once he had nothing to say, the one small advantage of this place abandoned by God. Baez was trying to look confident, but Pharaoh knew better. She watched his hand tremble when he took it from the reins to rub the water from his thick brows. She watched his mouth work when they stopped at junctions, watched him squinting into the rain, trying to reckon the right course. She saw his worry and his doubt written in his every movement. He knew as well as she did, this place was not safe. Click-clank. It came faint through the rain, like the sound of a hammer on a distant anvil, the sound of weapons being made ready. She stood up in her stirrups, straining to listen.
"Do you hear that?"
she snapped at Nine Fingers. He paused, squinting off at nothing, listening. Click-clank. He nodded slowly. "I hear it." He slid his sword out from its sheath.
"What?"
Luthar stared around wild-eyed, fumbling for his own weapons.
"There's nothing out there," grumbled Baez.
She jabbed her palm at them to stop, slid down from her saddle, and crept up to the corner of the next building, knocking an arrow to her bow, back sliding across the rough surface of the huge stone blocks. Clank-click. She could feel Nine Fingers following, moving carefully, a reassuring presence behind her. She slid round the corner onto one knee, peering across an empty square, pocked with pools and strewn with rubble. There was a high tower at the far corner, leaning over to one side, wide windows hanging open at its summit under a tarnished dome. Something was moving in there, slowly. Something dark, rocking back and forth. She almost smiled to have something she could point an arrow at. It was a good feeling, having an enemy. Then she heard hooves, and Baez rode past, out into the ruined square.
"Sss!"
she hissed at him, but he ignored her.
"You can put your weapons away," he called over his shoulder. "It's nothing but an old bell clicking in the wind. The city was full of them. You should have heard them pealing out when an emperor was born, or crowned, or married, or welcomed back from a victorious campaign."
He started to raise his arms, voice growing louder.
"The air split with their joyous ringing, and the birds rose up from every square and street and roof and filled the sky."
He was shouting now, bellowing it out.
"And the people lined the streets, and they leaned from their windows, and they showered the beloved with flower petals, and cheered until their voices were hoarse."
He started to laugh, and he let his arms fall, and high above him, the broken bell clicked and clanked in the wind.
"Long ago! Come on!"
Kwai snapped the reins, and the cart trundled off after the Magus. Nine Fingers shrugged at her and sheathed his sword. Pharaoh stayed a moment, staring up suspiciously at the stark outline of that leaning tower, dark clouds flowing past above it. Click-clank. Then she followed the others. The statues swam up out of the angry rain, one pair of frozen giants at a time, their faces all worn down by the long years, until every one was the featureless same. Water trickled over smooth marble, dripped from long beards, from armored skirts, from arms outstretched in threat or blessing, amputated long ago at the wrist or the elbow or the shoulder. Some were worked with bronze, huge helmets, swords, scepters, crowns of leaves, all turned chalky green, leaving dirty streaks down the gleaming stone. The statues swam up out of the angry rain, and one pair of giants at a time, they vanished into the rain behind, consigned to the mists of history.
"Emperors," said Baez, "hundreds of years of them."
Giselle watched the rulers of antiquity file menacingly past, looming over the broken road, his neck aching from looking up, the rain tickling at his face. The sculptures were twice the height or more of the ones in the Agriont, but there was similarity enough to cause a sudden wave of homesickness.
"Just like the Kingsway in Adua."
"Eh," grunted Baez.
"Where do you think I got the idea?"
Giselle was just absorbing that bizarre comment when he noticed that the statues they were approaching now were the last pair, one tilted over at a worrying angle.
"Hold up the cart,"
called Baez, raising one wet palm and nudging his horse forward. Not only were there no more emperors before them, there was no road at all. A dizzy drop yawned out of the earth, a mighty crack in the fabric of the city. Squinting across, Giselle could just see the far side, a cliff of broken rock and crumbled mud. Beyond were the faint wraiths of walls and pillars, the outline of the wide avenue melting out of sight and back as the rain swept through the empty air between. Longfoot cleared his throat.
"I take it we will not be carrying on this way."
Ever so carefully, Giselle leaned from his saddle and peered down. Far below, dark water moved, foaming and churning, washing at the tortured ground beneath the foundations of the city, and out of this subterranean sea stuck broken walls and shattered towers and the cracked open shells of monstrous buildings. At the top of one tottering column, a statue still stood, some hero long dead. His hand must once have been raised in triumph. Now it stuck up in desperation, as if he was pleading for someone to drag him from his watery hell. Giselle sat back, feeling suddenly dizzy.
"We will not be carrying on this way," he managed to croak.
Baez frowned grimly down at the grinding water.
"Then we must find another, and quickly. The city is full of these creeks. We have miles to go even on a straight course, and a bridge to cross."
Longfoot frowned.
"Providing it still stands."
"It still stands. Canadius built to last."
The first of the Magi peered up into the rain. The sky was already bruising, a dark weight hanging above their heads.
"We cannot afford to linger. We will not make it through the city before dark as it is."
Giselle looked up at the Magus, horrified.
"We'll be here overnight."
"Clearly,"
snapped Baez, turning his horse away from the brink. The ruins crowded in tighter around them as they left the Kaline Way behind and struck out into the thick of the city. Giselle gazed up at the threatening shadows looming from the murk. The only thing he could imagine worse than being trapped in this place by day was being kept there in the darkness. He would have preferred to spend the night in hell. But what would have been the difference? The river surged below them through a man-made canyon, tall embankments of smooth, wet stone. The mighty Eos, imprisoned in that narrow space, foamed with infinite, mindless fury, chewing at the polished rock and spitting angry spray high into the air. Pharaoh could not imagine how anything could have lasted for long above that deluge, but Baez had been right. The Maker's Bridge still stood.
"In all my wide travels, in every city and nation under the beautiful sun, I have never seen such a wonder."
Longfoot slowly shook his shaven head.
"How can a bridge be made from metal?"
But metal it was. Dark, smooth, lustreless, gleaming with drops of water. It soared across the dizzy space in one simple arch, impossibly delicate, a spider's web of thin rods crisscrossing the hollow air beneath it, a wide road of slotted metal plates stretching out perfectly level across the top, inviting them to cross. Every edge was sharp, every curve precise, every surface clean. It stood pristine in the midst of all that slow decay.
As if it was finished.